The Tom Woods Show, episode 1166.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Friends, my Away carry-on helps make my travel a pleasure. It's super strong yet lightweight. And it's even got its own USB charger built in. I'm like the king of the airport with this thing. Take $20 off your suitcase order when you head to awaytravel.com/woods and use promo code WOODS at checkout. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I've got a bit of a variety show for you today. I have a couple of clips I'm going to play for you that I hope you will enjoy. And then I have a story for you. A story that is one for the ages, let's just say. I've got one heck of a story. It may make you laugh. It should make you laugh. And it'll give you a nice momentum going into this long weekend. So I'm going to start with the clips, which have nothing to do with the story, by the way. The story is just a gift. It's my gift of happiness and joy to you. I'll just say that. For now, let me set up what I want to play for you. First, what we're going to hear is the opening statement I made back in 2009 at Freedom Fest, which, you know, we've had Mark Skousen, who's the director of Freedom Fest, on this show a couple of times. And that's been, I don't know how long Freedom Fest has been going on, but every year it's in Las Vegas, and a lot of people attend, a lot of people present. And that year I did a couple of things, and one of them was a debate on the Federal Reserve. And I'm going to play for you my opening statement in that debate. And it was a two-on-two debate, actually. It was Gene Epstein and I. Gene Epstein and I were on one side, and John Fund and Warren Coates were on the other. He was with the International Monetary Fund for quite a while. He's been an advisor to various central banks around the world. And then John Fund, of course, wrote for the Wall Street Journal. Gene Epstein, I think by now, a lot of listeners of this show know Gene very well, and he spent many years as economics editor at Barron's. So it turns out that Gene and I have had a partnership going back quite some time. So I didn't know Gene that well at that point. I knew him a little, and I'm not sure we had ever met in person. And I wasn't sure, shows how little I knew him, I wasn't sure how feisty he'd be. I wasn't sure how much of a fighter he'd be. Man, he was devastating. He was amazing. That was so great. Anyway, the long and the short of this is, I think I may have told this story before, but Warren Coates got his opportunity to give his opening statement, but he was such a bad manager of time that the only thing he managed to say to us and to the large audience there was, yes, I admit central banks have made a lot, because the debate was, should we abolish the Fed? And he says, yeah, I admit central banks have made a lot of mistakes, but we can't throw out the baby with the bathwater. That was going to be his thesis. But all we got to was the mistakes. He never got to his positive case because he managed his time so poorly that he ran out of time before he could get to his positive case. So I thought, oh my gosh, we got this thing in the bag. So it was an okay debate, but what I fault myself for looking back on it is that I was just too timid. I was too unsure of myself. And I thought, well, you know, we got this IMF guy. I mean, he knows more than I do. But, you know, that's, you can tell I was still a youngster in those days. I had this naive confidence, you know, in other people who, just because they have establishment credentials, whereas I would not feel that way today. Not to say there aren't smart people in the establishment, that sure there are, but I definitely had things to say that I should have been more assertive about saying. But nonetheless, here is my opening statement. We had 5 minutes to deliver it. I came in just under 5 minutes, but you'll notice that although I think I have a pretty good speaking style, and I include in that the speed at which I deliver my material, this is delivered a little bit faster than usual, but that's simply because I did have a lot to say, and I did want to get all this in the 5 minutes that were allotted to me. So here we are, 2009, Freedom Fest, the first of the four opening statements. Each one of us in this two-on-two debate got an opening statement. I was the first one to go. And here it is, and I hope you like it.
A lot of people seem to believe that although the market economy is a swell system, it requires the equivalent of a Soviet commissar to be in charge of money and interest rates. This belief is altogether misplaced. The Federal Reserve System, or simply the Fed, is both harmful and unnecessary. Since the Fed's creation in 1913, the dollar has lost at least 95% of its value. If the much maligned gold standard had produced such a result, we'd never hear the end of it. But in our system, the Fed is, for whatever reason, curiously exempt from criticism. Under the Fed, therefore, people have lost an option they once had, namely accumulating savings in cash. Under a commodity standard, people could save for the future simply by accumulating precious metal coins, which back when they functioned as money, held or even increased their value. No one has that option any longer. In other words, only a fool would try to save by piling up dollar bills. Instead, everyone is forced to become a speculator and to invest in securities markets they know little about and that can wipe them out entirely if times turn bad. As early as the 18th century, Richard Cantillon identified distribution effects as another way inflation harms the general public. The newly created money is injected at particular points. Whoever receives it first, in other words, people who happen to be politically well-connected, get to spend it before prices have commensurately risen, and they thereby enjoy a windfall. By the time it trickles down to the general public, those people have been paying the higher prices to which the new money gives rise all that time. Private and public debt have exploded under this system, especially since the collapse of Bretton Woods in 1971. No one has a right to be surprised when indebtedness skyrockets under a system in which credit can be created out of thin air. The very existence of the Fed, a central bank, institutionalizes the problem of moral hazard. Moral hazard involves an actor's willingness to behave with an artificially elevated level of risk because he believes any losses he may incur will be borne by someone else. Since there is no physical limitation on paper money creation, market actors know the paper money producer can bail them out if things go terribly wrong. They have been vindicated in this belief time and again. They will, therefore, be more reckless in their investment activity and speculation than would otherwise be the case. We were once told that boom-bust business cycles were a thing of the past because, thanks to the Fed, we now had scientific management of the money supply. If anyone believes that today, I'd like to meet him. Artificially low interest rates, courtesy of the Fed, do not in fact yield us a utopia of sunshine and kittens. To the contrary, they artificially stimulate capital goods production and long-term investment. They thereby deform the structure of production into a configuration that the public's freely expressed pattern of saving and consumption will not be able to sustain. When this phony boom inevitably collapses, it is capitalism that is stupidly blamed, when in fact the Fed, a non-market institution, is the culprit. I am interested in neither the saccharine promises nor the technical details of the alleged superiority of a monopoly fiat money system. The Fed is the lifeblood of the empire, the great enabler of the perversion of the original American Republic into the world's largest and most powerful government. Even if the Fed did confer a net economic benefit, a contention the great Austrian economists F.A. Hayek and Ludwig von Mises strenuously denied, in fact, Hayek won the Nobel Prize in the process of denying it, even if the Fed did confer a net economic benefit, the alleged benefit could not possibly be worth the destruction of the American soul. As it turns out, we don't have to make that choice. When it comes to the Fed, justice, economic prosperity, and the values of the original American Republic are joined together. The Fed, its academic apologists, and the drones in our supposedly free press who demonize all dissent from the monetary status quo have done our economy enough damage. For the sake of American freedom and prosperity, it is long past time that, in the spirit of Andrew Jackson, we killed the monster. Thank you.
All right, everybody. That is the bird's eye overview. That's the big picture case against the Fed. Obviously, there's a lot more that can be said. There are a lot more details that can be provided. But that's the, I think those are the basic contours of the argument. Now, if you listen to my show regularly and you haven't read any of my books, I want to urge you to rethink that. Not because I make a lot of money from books. And by the way, not that I mind advertising for anything I do, but I don't make much money from books, but I feel like they're helpful. I think they are a significant portion of the contribution that I think I've made. And one thing that I can surely tell you about them is that there's no fluff in them. It's all just packed with material. So whether they're short or medium size or whatever, you're going to get the equivalent of a long book because I just pack a lot in there. So for this, what I really recommend is my book Rollback, the stuff on the Fed in there is pretty darn good, if you ask me, making the case against it. There's also my book Meltdown, which wound up being a New York Times bestseller for 10 weeks about the financial crisis, and that's got some stuff on the Fed in there. So you might want to check those out. The audiobook versions, by the way, I don't know if there is. Yeah, there is one for Rollback. Yeah. The audiobook versions of my book, you can get one of them for free. You can get one for free. If you have not yet joined Audible, when you join Audible, they'll give you a free book for joining. And then even if you decide to quit, you still keep the free book. So, you know, might as well go ahead and give it a try. So do that over at TomWoodsAudio.com. The only one of my books for which I read the book, I was the narrator, was my book Real Descent, which is I actually think is my favorite, maybe not my greatest contribution, but it's my favorite because it's a series of short responses. Usually it's responses to bad guys, and it's fun smacking down terrible people. I don't just mean people who disagree with me. Like somebody like Murray Polner disagrees with me. He's not a terrible person, and I wouldn't want to rake him over the coals. I'd want to have him for coffee, and we'll talk it through. But there are some truly terrible people. I mean, you saw what they did to Ron Paul. That's terrible. So I had no mercy, and I collected a lot of these into the book Real Descent. The idea being that there's only fake dissent normally in the media. You know, when people dissent about American foreign policy, it's some trivial dissent that never questions the whole imperial structure. Or people who have a problem with some little bit of monetary policy have some little technical disagreement, but they don't actually have a full-throated opposition, which is what I have. So this is where you're going to find Real Descent. I think it is such a fun book to read. So I also recommend Real Descent, and it is read by me in my own voice. So you can get the audiobook for that also for free when you sign up for Audible at TomWoodsAudio.com. And then for the print versions of my books, you've got them at TomWoods.com/books, or obviously at Amazon, but at TomWoods.com/books, you can get an easy, convenient list of all of them with just one click. So check that out. The second thing I want to set up for you is another discussion of money, but it's a little bit more specific. And before I get to that, I actually would like to just, I mean, this is sort of a, you know, this is a sponsored bit, but this actually happened to me. This is absolutely the truth. Last month, I flew to New York. I've been flying to New York all year. I just love being there. I have friends there. I know it's run by terrible people, but I'm not going to let the terrorists win. If I have friends, I want to go visit them. So I went there because I wanted to see Stephen Wilson in concert. And if you are one of my listeners who knows who that is, you belong to the elite of the elite. So I went to that. And by the way, while I was in town, it so happens that Anthony Samaroff, who's been on this show a few times, for once for a bonus episode and at least one other time, he's such a great guy. He's a co-host of the Scottish Liberty podcast. He just happened to be in town from Scotland. I mean, what are the chances? And I found that out. I said, whoa, we got to have dinner. So we went and had dinner. It was tremendous and great. Anyway, so it was a wonderful trip. But as I was preparing for the trip, I could not find my Away carry-on. Now, you know I love the Away carry-on. I promote it on the show. But I genuinely love my Away carry-on. I said, where the heck is this thing? I couldn't believe it. So the family's all interrogating me about why it matters which suitcase I take. I could not believe they were asking me such an impertinent question. And I said, well, I'll tell you why. And I am not joking. I proceeded to say something like the following. I said, look, it gives me this amazing glide through the airport with its really smooth 4 360-degree spinner wheels. It's made with premium German polycarbonate, which makes it super strong but also lightweight. And then I went on to say, and it's got this compression system, which is great for overpackers like me, and it's got a TSA-approved combination lock on the top. And I just went on and on and on. It's got this removable laundry bag that's washable, that keeps your dirty clothes separate from everything else. And I sat there and just kept rattling these things off, and I thought, what has happened to me? Well, I did find it. It was hidden in a closet somewhere, and you're darn right I used that on my way to New York. Well, you should try it out, too. It's got a lifetime warranty. If anything breaks, they will fix or replace it for you for life. It's got a 100-day trial. If you don't like it, return it. No questions asked. Free shipping on any Away order within the lower 48 states. And remember, for $20 off a suitcase, visit awaytravel.com/woods and use promo code WOODS during checkout. That's $20 off a suitcase at awaytravel.com/woods using promo code WOODS during checkout. The second clip I'm going to play is longer. It's a full interview. But don't turn off this episode after that interview because I've got this great story for you. It's going to make the whole episode. This is an episode of the Gold Money podcast that the folks at goldmoney.com do. And this is from about 5 years ago, actually. So I think I was just getting started on the Ron Paul curriculum material, heaven help me. What we start off talking about here is a paper that I gave at the Mises Institute at their scholarly conference about the greenbackers. This is a name that's been applied to people today who are against the Fed, but not for quite the reasons that you and I might be. Their argument would be the Fed is too stingy, that it needs to inflate more. Or they'll be concerned that the Fed is a private institution, which it is a kind of weird hybrid of public and private. It's obviously not purely private. I think that's just a red herring. The problem with the Fed is not that it isn't socialistic enough. I never understood that objection. But they'll have these kind of irrelevant objections, or they'll just be entirely wrongheaded in their monetary policy. In fact, I heard one greenbacker say, I don't know anybody who feels like he has too many Federal Reserve notes, so that just proves they're not making enough of them. But couldn't you apply that to any good in society? I don't know anybody who has enough BMWs. You know, you could always have an extra one. So I don't know. So it's just all confused. And unfortunately, a lot of these folks had been coming into the Ron Paul movement because they saw end the Fed and they thought, oh, good, let's end the Fed and let's have the government exercise its money monopoly more directly by having the Treasury do the inflation. And I just feel like that's missing the point. I mean, you're not understanding why we're against the Fed. This is a trivial reason to be against the Fed. In other words, we more or less accept the Fed's mission. We just want somebody else carrying it out. This is not an earth-shattering critique. So I wrote a paper on this to respond to them because I hadn't seen anybody from the Austrian school respond to the arguments of the greenbackers. So I wrote a paper on this, and I mentioned it in this interview that you're going to hear, that you can read it at tomwoods.com/paper if this is a topic that interests you. So we heard in my opening statement for that debate just now something like a bird's eye view of the whole picture. And now we're going to get a little bit of detail about some folks, namely these greenbackers, who are anti-Fed, but they're getting the issue kind of all wrong. So with that, here we go. Hope you enjoy it.
Hello and welcome to this Gold Money Foundation podcast with me, your host, Andy Duncan. Again, I'm in Auburn, Alabama at the Mises Institute. And today I'm speaking to the historian, Tom Woods. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Andy.
Now, you did a great speech yesterday. It was on why greenbackers are wrong. Now, we've associated greenbackers with the End the Fed movement because they kind of want to end the Federal Reserve too. So can you tell us why you think greenbackers are wrong?
Right. Well, the greenbackers are people who will tell you as soon as they suspect that you may have some misgivings about the current monetary system that you should go watch a video called The Money Masters, or they've got all these videos you should watch. And, you know, there may be 30% of it that's pretty good, but by and large, the prescription they have is that we need to get rid of the Fed so that we can have a more direct government form of money creation and not have this private banking system that we have now. Now, of course, this is a libel on the private sector to call the current banking system a private banking system, or to think that the problems with our banking system is that it isn't socialistic enough, which is implicitly what the greenbackers are saying. And they expect us to have this sort of naive confidence in the political class. So, of course, that's wrong. I hardly think this is even debatable. But I was even going into some of the more detailed aspects of their claims because they've been making these claims for decades. Gary North has answered them, but very few people have actually bothered to answer them, because they have no real base, they're not in academia, they have no influence, so why bother? I think it's worth bothering because they do bring along a lot of otherwise, I think, decent folks who might be conspiratorially inclined, and so they hear this and they think, aha, the banks are in conspiracy against us, we need the great public servants of ours to be in charge of the money, which it seems to me, why don't they think conspiratorially about those people? I don't know. But one of the arguments they make, we don't need to go into the details, but is that when you have a system like ours where the banks create the money, for example, the commercial banks create money when you go to borrow $1,000, they just ding their computers and they give you a passbook with $1,000 listed on it. And they create that out of thin air, but that's a loan that they create to you. And so all the money is created in the form of loans. So they lend you $1,000. But when you go to repay that $1,000, they never created the $100 in interest that you owe. So their argument is the banks enslave us because they create enough money for the principal of the loan, but they don't create enough money to pay the interest. And they want it this way. They want us to default so that they can then come in and confiscate our collateral and all that. So I just thought enough's enough. Enough decent people have been taken in by this. So at my website, tomwoods.com, I set up a page where you can read my response to the Greenbackers. It's just tomwoods.com/paper. And of course, I meant by paper, I meant here's my paper I'm giving at the conference. But I guess I also mean paper because that's their solution to the monetary problem.
In a country, I mean, I'm English, so America's not my history at all. But even I know that you have this thing called a continental from the Continental War when you let the king and the queen go and everything else. Now, with a country which has a phrase such as not worth a continental, how do these greenbackers think that the money supply will be controlled once it's given to the government completely?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, they have what I think are sort of contrived answers to all historical episodes that you might raise against them to the contrary. So for the Continental, they claim that, well, that was debased only because of British counterfeiting. It had nothing to do with the policy. And yet you can see how quickly the issues of the Continental multiplied and multiplied and multiplied. So I'm not inclined to buy that explanation. But I haven't found it could be my fault. But honestly, the best that I can think of as a Greenbacker response in terms of something that I've heard them say is that, well, when no system is perfect, but at least if our public servants are in charge of the money, then we've got some kind of control over them. We have no control over the Federal Reserve. So if they go off the rails, we'll make sure and rein them in. And I feel like saying, well, how did that work on the bailouts that nobody favored but yet nevertheless went through? How did we rein them in on that one? And secondly, who says the American public would want to rein in inflation necessarily? Yeah, they don't like high prices, but if they associate reining in inflation with reining in Medicare and Social Security, you know, they won't favor that. So I think their assurances are rather on the naive side.
Yeah, now you explained quite nicely how in 1933, when the American government took all the gold and gave people paper notes back and then exchanged dollars for it, those dollars weren't debt-based. But surely if you're against debt-based money, you should move towards a free market money such as gold.
Right. And when they talk about debt-based money, they're talking about exactly what I said earlier, where in our system, the money enters the economy when banks issue loans to people. And because the commercial banks can't create dollar bills in the U.S., but what they can do is create these electronic accounts, and they say, here's your $1,000, and people go and write checks on this $1,000. But that's a debt. It's a loan from the bank to somebody, and their argument is that, as I said, we can't repay all these debts because there isn't enough money to repay the interest. So we need money that isn't in any way encumbered by debt, that has no connection to debt whatsoever. And what I was arguing in my paper is, well, then free market and money is exactly what you want, because when on the free market, when money is created like any other commodity, when gold is mined and then minted into coins and spent into the economy, where's the loan involved? There's no loan there. There's no debt there. That's just spending the money into the economy. So it seems like this way you don't need the so-called private bankers and you don't need Nancy Pelosi or John McCain. This should be like a Greenbacker's dream. This is your debt-free money. But if what you want is inflation more than you want debt-free money, then you won't like that solution.
So why do they want this inflation? Why do they think that this paper money will be a good thing?
Well, when you look at what their political outlook is, of course, there's a variety of perspectives. But by and large, they tend to be people who would have supported Franklin Roosevelt, who would have supported Alexander Hamilton in U.S. history, people who favored a powerful government, but who were perceived, at least in FDR's case, who were perceived as acting in the interest of the public against the – you can't say this for Hamilton – but acting in the interest of the public against the wealthy fat cats. And they tend to believe that this is how you create full employment. This is how you put people to work. You can't rely on the free market to resolve these things. But they honestly believe that you don't have to take my word for it. If you look up Ellen Brown – she basically believes that full employment can be brought about by inflation and that our problem is not scarcity. We have conquered scarcity. The only scarcity we have is a scarcity of money. And if we had more money, we could grease the skids of more transactions, more people would be put to work. I mean, it is like a perpetual motion machine that they think they can create simply with inflation. It is a utopian view. And being a utopian view, it's not something that you can debate using economic theory.
Yeah. One of my favorite novels is The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
I love that.
Got the Golgafringians who land on Earth, and they think they've got a problem with money, so they declare leaves as legal tender. And then they start burning down all of the forests to limit their money supply, which I think is hilarious. Okay, so let's assume that we've persuaded all of the greenbackers and all the people who believe in government paper money to come to our side. How do we move then, do you think, to a proper free market money?
Well, I think the way you do it is one step at a time, and it has to be through a gradual series of steps, especially because if you're going to make a change of this import, dealing with something that everybody uses, then and considering also that the vast majority of the public doesn't realize there is really a problem with the money, has never thought about money, has never thought about where money comes from, what its purpose is. And most people don't even remotely give this a second thought. To suddenly radically change this without the public on board is probably impossible. So the way you have to do it is introduce it gradually by getting people to at least acknowledge and realize that some people want to use other ways of transacting. They want to use other media of exchange. So you remove all obstacles in the path of alternative monies. So in the U.S., for example, there are contractual limits on – because we have legal tender laws, you can't contract with somebody and say, you must pay me in gold, because they are always – free to pay you in U.S. dollars, because that's legal tender. No contract to the country can take away the fact that you are obligated to accept the legal tender of the country. So there are contractual restrictions on having transactions in other currencies, and then there are taxes of various kinds on other currencies. So we get rid of all those, and then we get rid of the legal tender laws. And again, that sounds like an extreme measure to some people too, but you just explain that to people by saying, well, isn't this a free country? We put them on the defensive. Isn't this a free country? Why, if the dollar is such a great thing, which most people, when faced with change, will say, well, what's wrong with the dollar? I use it all the time. If it's so great, why does it need monopoly protection? It'll survive on its own. And so just one layer at a time, you get people using other things. And you say to people, if you want to keep using the depreciating dollar, you go right ahead. But the rest of us who might want to have something more stable, we ought to be free to do that. And then you just see in the free marketplace of money what people tend to prefer. And over time, as one layer of government support after another is removed, then you get closer to a free market solution.
Yeah. So one of these first steps has to then be, if you want to get the public on your side, a kind of education process. Now, you're doing great work there with speeches around the country and so on. And you're doing things in Iowa, I believe. Can you tell us what you're doing in Iowa?
Oh, this is fun. Yeah. So in Iowa, obviously your listeners know who Ron Paul is. Uh-huh. And we're all skeptical of the political parties and everything. But in Iowa, which is a real battleground state politically in the U.S., the Republican Party in that state has basically been taken over completely by the Ron Paul people. The top people are all Ron Paul. They're all people who ran his campaign. And so what they want to do is have a series of events around Iowa where our kind of liberty message is brought to the grassroots average Iowa Republican. And the way they want to do this is have these events be events where we're doing one next month. It's going to be a three-hour event and several people will be involved, but I'm going to speak three times. That's the key of the event, is I'm speaking three times. And as the topics go on, they get more challenging and more challenging to their existing worldview. So yeah. I'm going to start off with the economy, but I'm not going to give the usual Republican boilerplate about we need lower taxes. Well, you know, no kidding. I want to talk about the Fed. I want to talk about the bailouts that all these Republicans who believe in the free market were all telling us we had to support. You can't be a free market purist, and there are no atheists in foxholes, and there are no free marketeers during a crisis and all that. I'm going to say, look, either we're free marketeers or we're not. Either we're cronies or we're capitalists. So I'm going to give them a totally different – I'm going to say, if you really want the free market, don't vote for Newt Gingrich, for heaven's sake, right? Then the second thing will be the topic of state nullification of federal laws, which is gaining traction in the U.S. And then finally, Those two topics, I will have them cheering. I guarantee you I'll have them cheering. I wouldn't have Newt cheering.
I feel like cheering now.
I appreciate that. But these are like the average person in the Republican Party in Iowa, they kind of feel like that's what their party stands for. Then the third speech will be on foreign policy. And that's where I take all the capital I've built up with them and I blow it in one half an hour speech. Right. But I think I can explain it to them in a way that they will walk away thinking, at the very least, they'll think, I need to give this some thought. At the very least.
That's good. Do you think then that you're going to be approached to become a politician yourself? Do you think that you'll be asked to stand for being a senator?
This happens to me every day. It happens constantly. I'm getting this all the time. But
and what's your response? Are you going to do it?
No. I don't have any interest in doing it. And it would require an absolutely enormous commitment of time, which is very hard to do when you're a guy with four kids and the oldest is nine.
Yeah.
I don't want to do it to them. But secondly, I just don't want to have to – I'm not the sort of person who would weigh my every word. I would say what I think, and if I said what I thought, I would get no votes. Mm-hmm. Even people who think they want to support me wouldn't vote for me. And then also, I would be called all kinds of, I'm an extremist, and look, he doesn't even favor this, he doesn't, and you know, I'm just not doing that. I have too much of a paper trail, and I think I'd have to spend too many of my resources running around defending myself all the time. I think it would be a waste of decent people's money. So I'd rather stay on the sidelines, do what I'm doing there.
It's amazing, isn't it, how Ron Paul found the energy over those many decades to do what he did.
Yeah, and of course, he was flying under the radar for a long time. But after 2007, he had many, many people who loved him, would crawl over broken glass for him. But then he also attracted enemies of a degree of nastiness that I'm sure he had never encountered in his career. And yet he handled that with dignity and grace. He never let it bother him. He just carried on because he was he had that assurance that for every one of these people who would insult him, there were 100 cheering him.
Yeah. Now, I want you to be spared as well from politics so you can write more books. Now, my favorite book of yours is, I've read quite a few of them, is Meltdown.
Oh, thanks.
Which came out within 10 seconds of, of the economy melting down. So that was good. It was quick off the mark.
Yeah.
But there were some great things on there, such as the 1921 Depression, which never happened because the Federal Reserve didn't do anything.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, until after the NBER said that it had already stopped. Yeah.
Now, do you think that where do you think we are in the current meltdown? Do you think we're still bouncing along the bottom, or are we going to go even further down, or where are we in the current meltdown?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it's true that we've seen the Dow Jones reaching these so-called record levels nominally, but it's worth remembering what the strategy of the Federal Reserve has been since the Greenspan years. When we look at the stock market, we should remember a point that David Stockman makes in his forthcoming book, which you should read this and have him on. Because it's called The Great Deformation. It's a huge book, but you will love this book. I have a pre-publication copy. Mm-hmm. Just the first three chapters completely dismantle all the arguments for the bailouts that you've ever heard. Now, I did that a little bit in Meltdown, but David Stockman makes me look like a lazy bum.
And he worked for the Reagan.
He worked in the Reagan administration. Mm-hmm. He's extremely smart. So, well, all the same, what he points out in that book is that the Fed has been aiming at what's called the wealth effect. What we'll try to do is gin up the stock market so that wealthy investors feel wealthier. Yeah. And because they feel wealthier, they'll be inclined to borrow more and to spend more. This will stimulate economic activity. Now, notice this is not a free market approach.
It's all the wrong way around, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. Right. So they're trying to manipulate. And what they want are these metrics by which they can say, look at how wonderfully the Fed has managed the economy. I mean, employment is high, the stock market is high. So when the stock market is high, I just think, well, the Fed is engaged in the wealth effect again. And when you look at what were the actual results of Fed policy, you look at the key boom years, look at 2000, 2007. What is fascinating is that even though population, of course, grew during those years, the number of net breadwinner jobs created during those years was zero.
Oh, wow.
So, if you really want a statistic that shows you how phony their manipulation is, there it is. But meanwhile, Greenspan was getting all the credit because look at the growth and look at all these figures. Yeah, they make sure that those figures look good. But the average guy is not benefiting from this.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing how they can get away with such things. Do you have any more books coming out soon at all?
I don't right now, simply because I'm working on a huge project. I have two big projects that are super important to me. One is a website I started last year called libertyclassroom.com, where I teach courses and other people I trust teach, like Austrian economics, U.S. history, all that sort of thing. We're going to add a course on Keynesianism. What are the errors of Keynes and what are the correct views of the Austrians?
Yeah.
So that's the sort of thing you can learn in your car sort of thing. So that's my libertyclassroom.com. But the other thing is I am working on a kindergarten through grade 12 homeschool curriculum.
Oh, wow.
That will be basically from our sort of point of view, but not just, it won't just be that kids who take this will have a real knowledge of money and all that stuff. They will. But they will also be trained in public speaking. They will all have a blog. They'll all have a YouTube channel.
Yeah.
They won't just have this information sitting vainly in their heads. They will have the skills to go out there and proselytize for these ideas.
Yeah. So it's not going to be so much Khan Academy as a kind of Woods Academy.
There'll be another person's name attached to it that I can't announce just now, but I have a letter, woodsletter.com. I send out a free letter every month, and I'll be making the announcement there. But this is the most exciting because I think the most long, in terms of the long term, potentially life-changing sort of thing. That if you could get, I think this project will take at least tens of thousands of American kids out of the government schools and equip them with knowledge and skills that are going to make our movement much, much stronger in the future.
That's great. Fantastic work that you're doing. Now, we've got other lectures going on today, such as Professor Salerno and things that we both probably want to go and see. So it's been great you giving me your time today.
Thank you very much, Andy.
Tom Woods.
Anytime. Thanks.
All right, everybody, you ready? Ready for my story? Now, if you're on my email list, you may know the story, but it's fun to hear it again anyway. If you're not on my email list, you may think, well, email, who wants to get more email? You do. That's who. You do. You want to get my emails because they're fun and informative and full of incisive commentary that I very often don't publish anywhere else. I don't really write articles anymore. I like to write to people who have told me they want to hear from me. And so they get all the exclusive stuff that I write. And you should jump on this because everybody's always talking about my email list. So if you're not on it, you're going to feel very, very bad about yourself. And if I can prevent that, I'd like to. So you can hop on my list at tomsfreebooks.com. Just look at, you can get any one of those books as a gift when you opt into the list. You can get all of them if you want. But anyway, here's what happened to me the other day. I have a secret Facebook group as just one of the benefits that I give to people who belong to my Supporting Listeners program at supportinglisteners.com. And I had a woman who was extremely unhappy about this. Now, you can tell from the kind of language she uses that she is a little bit tone deaf. I don't think she quite gets who I am or what she would have discovered in my Facebook group. But I say, look, you got to pay at least 5 smackers a month to get into that secret Facebook group. And I have reasons for that. I mean, it keeps the crazies out. I'm telling you, if there's one thing that keeps crazy people out, it's asking them to pony up something. Then they're gone and they don't bother you. So that's just a bit of advice for you. It is a screen that keeps crazy people out. So anyway, here's what I wrote in my email the other day. I told the story of working with Alan Brinkley as my PhD dissertation advisor at Columbia. He was the son of David Brinkley. My older listeners, older like me, will know the name David Brinkley from the show This Week with David Brinkley, and then he was a newscaster before that for many, many years. In fact, there's a Macy's Day Parade episode of The Simpsons, and they actually have David Brinkley, the character, as a character on there, and they do such a perfect impression of David Brinkley. Well, anyway, so his son was my dissertation advisor, so he's Alan Brinkley, extremely, establishment-oriented, left liberal, but establishment. I mean, he loved the establishment. I don't really recall knowing that many people who genuinely loved the establishment, but Alan Brinkley did, who, by the way, was an entirely decent person to me, was very helpful to me. I mean, once I expanded it to make it into a full-fledged book, I wound up getting my dissertation published as a book by Columbia University Press. And that was in no small part due to the great work Alan Brinkley had done with me in advising me on it. So I'm not in any way trying to make fun of this guy when I say stuff like that. Well, anyway, Alan Brinkley told us one day, he says, as the son of a famous person, I can tell you something. you get mail from crazy people once in a while. He says, so when you as a historian are going through and reading all these manuscript collections and collections of letters, you're going to see just the occasional nutcase. And, well, I'm no David Brinkley, but I have a little bit of notoriety, and I heard from a completely crazy person. And this is what she wrote. I'm going to read exactly what she wrote. Now, you're going to listen to this. You're going to think, this can't be real. She must just be being sarcastic, or satirical, rather. This must be satire. There's no way anybody could possibly say these things. But I actually carried on a little correspondence with her afterward. And if anything, what you're about to hear understates the level of craziness we're dealing with. So here's what she wrote. How thoroughly unpatriotic of you. Which is such a weird thing to say about me. She says, you're using a free Facebook page, but you don't want to educate anyone or assist anyone in beating off the leftist trolls. You just want to collect your cash. You, sir, are a selfish prig and may well be a rhino/leftist tool. Fortunately, I belong to several other secret Facebook and not-so-secret pages that are full of intelligent and patriotic, in all caps, members who will no doubt provide thoughtful information and debate for free. And I will make it my personal goal to get the news of your selfishness out to as many people as I can find to listen, including the president and conservative Senate/House members. One last thing. May the fleas of 1,000 camels infest both your armpits and your home. And you think, okay, that's not real. That there's just nobody is that crazy. Like she's going to tell Donald Trump that I charge access to a benefit? Like Donald Trump is going to have a moral problem with charging for something? I forwarded this email on to Ben Settle, who's been a guest on this show a few times, who's an email marketing expert, and he wrote back to say he was jealous. He said, that email is so perfect, I'm jealous. Because before Ben Settle, I would have just had a chuckle at this woman and then just moved on. After Ben Settle, I make an email out of it. So I made a funny email, I reproduced her email, and then I reproduced my reply to her. Here was my reply. You're right, I don't want to educate anyone. I've released only 1,164 free podcast episodes, hundreds of free videos, hundreds of free articles, and given hundreds of free lectures around the country. And then I said, the measly $5 a month that I ask for keeps the crazies out of my group. You are living proof that the strategy works. Oh, that's a sick burn, my friends. That one, I told my 13-year-old Veronica that, and she just burst out laughing when she heard that line. She couldn't believe I had actually written that. Oh, yeah, look, hey, your dad can be kind of saucy when he needs to. I'm not even sure that's what that word means, but I think I know. Anyway, I just thought you guys would get a kick out of that. I hear from people like this from time to time, and I have fun. I make examples out of them. I say, no. In fact, I said to people, if you decide to join at supportinglisteners.com, rest assured my vetting process is keeping people like this out. So come on over there. All right. That's all I have to say. Love to have you in the group. It's over at supportinglisteners.com. And I've had a few people, by the way, say, I joined, but I don't know how to get into the Facebook group. The instructions for getting into the group are inside the members area at supportinglisteners.com. That's how you find how to get in there. Because it's a secret group. It's not just a private group. It's a secret group. So you can't just type in Tom Woods Show Elite and find it. Facebook will say, we don't know what you're talking about. There is no such group. Yeah, just the way I like it. All right, everybody, that is it. I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.